Democrat and a top ally of Joe Biden laid out their ideas on Sunday as the country came to grips with the siege of the Capitol by Donald Trump loyalists trying to overturn the election results. "Let's give President-elect Biden the 100 days he needs to get his agenda off and running," Jim Clyburn said. The push by House Democrats came after the office of the Colorado Democratic Representative Jason Crow released a readout of a call in which Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy indicated that the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, is aware of further possible threats posed by would-be terrorists in the days up to and including Inauguration Day. According to the readout, Ryan McCarthy said the Pentagon was working with local and federal law enforcement to coordinate security preparations for 20th of January. Democratic Representative Jason Crow, a former U.S. Army Ranger, said he had raised grave concerns about reports that active duty and reserve military members were involved in the insurrection and asked that troops deployed for the inauguration are not sympathetic to domestic terrorists. The readout said Ryan McCarthy agreed and said he was willing to testify publicly in the coming days. On Sunday, Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania joined colleague Lisa Murkowski of Alaska in calling for Donald Trump to resign and go away as soon as possible. "I think the president has disqualified himself from ever certainly serving in office again," Pat Toomey said. "I don't think he's electable in any way." Lisa Murkowski, who has long voiced her exasperation with Donald Trump's conduct in office, told the Anchorage Daily News on Friday that Trump simply needs to get out. A third Republican, Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri, did not go that far, but on Sunday, he warned Donald Trump to be very careful in his final days in office. Corporate America began to tie its reaction to the Capitol riots by tying them to campaign contributions. Citigroup's head of global government affairs, Candy Wolf, said in a Friday memo to employees, "We want you to be assured that we will not support candidates who do not respect the rule of law." House leaders, furious after the insurrection, appear determined to act against Donald Trump despite the short timeline. Another idea being considered was to have a separate vote that would prevent Donald Trump from ever holding office again. That could potentially only need a simple majority vote of 51 senators, unlike impeachment, in which two-thirds of the 100-member Senate must support a conviction. The Senate was set to be split evenly at 50-50, but under Democratic control, once Vice President-elect Kamala Harris and two Democrats who won Georgia's Senate runoff elections last week are sworn in. Kamala Harris would be the Senate's tie-breaking vote. The FBI and other agencies are continuing their examination of the circumstances of the insurrection, including allegations that Pentagon officials loyal to Donald Trump blocked the deployment of National Guard troops for 3 hours after officials called for help. "We couldn't actually cross over the border into Washington, D.C. without the okay, and that was quite some time coming," the Republican governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan, told CNN. Larry Hogan added, "Eventually I got a call from the Secretary of the Army asking if we could come into the city, but we had already been mobilized, we already had our police, we already had our guard mobilized, and we were just waiting for that phone call."
economic divide.
Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to Economic Divide with Mika Vitaplai. To start off the year, we're going to be taking a look at the Saudi Arabian budget deficit, a deficit that has a sum of around 79 billion U.S. dollars, something that will no doubt pinch the pockets of the world's largest oil producer. Now, for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the reliance on oil is something that is reflected heavily in its GDP. Yet, as we can see from this chart over here, the impact of the coronavirus on oil prices around the world was the second largest fall in history, when in March 2020, prices fell by 31.5%. So, how did the oil crash affect the Saudi GDP? Again, let's refer to this next graph that you see over here. We can see that until Q3 of 2019, that's the bar that you see here on Q3, GDP had a positive growth rate, yet with the arrival of the COVID-19 virus and a global fall in the demand for oil, the Saudi GDP slipped with Q2. Seeing a 7.5% drop that is reflected over here for Q2, and then moving on to Q3, that dropped to around 4% as you see in this chart. Now, with uncertainty still surrounding a recovery, no wonder things are looking down for the Saudis. Let's now take a look at our first report and look at the global oil crash in more detail and see just how Saudi Arabia has been hit the hardest.
Things were looking very rosy for the bank account of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia over the last decade. With 266 billion barrels of proven oil reserves, the boom times certainly allowed the dollars to flow into the nation, allowing the despotic Saudi royal family to rule a reign of lavish luxury, whilst letting ordinary citizens slip into poverty. But in 2020, the world woke up to the impact of the COVID-19 crisis, a world pandemic that would affect the health and lives of millions and bring economies to their knees, and things were no different for the Saudis. Whereas the KSA has not been immune to the virus in terms of human costs, in fact, with 363,000 cases recorded and over 6,200 deaths, it's the impact on the economy that's truly hit home with Riyadh, with the GDP falling some 7.5%, since the start of 2020. The reason for this has been the sharp drop in the price of oil. As the virus has clearly demonstrated over the last 12 months, the demand for fuel has slipped, falling from $71.34 a barrel in 2018 to a year low of just $9.12 per barrel in 2020, something that the Saudis were not expecting, it seems, as the national budget deficit is now a staggering $79 billion. To add insult to the injury, an economic war was triggered in March 2020 between the Saudi regime and Russia, with oil prices at the heart of the battle. The price sparked a quarterly fall of 65% in oil prices, with crude and Brent falling around 25%. The resulting oil war, as well as the effect of the COVID-19 virus, sparked a global stock market crash, costing trillions. With the world still yet to recover from the various impacting factors in 2020, things are not looking too bright for Saudi Arabia, with oil prices still low and a budget deficit that has hurt its economy.
Joining me in the studio today is Atife Padidar. Atife, welcome and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us here today. Okay, now before we get into details about the Saudi oil crisis, we spoke to Hossein Askari. He's a professor of international business at the George Washington University, and he's also a former board member on the IMF, and he was an advisor to the Saudi Ministry of Finance. Well, let's listen to what he said about how the crash has affected the Saudi economy and how the average Saudi is faring now compared to the so-called boom years.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's very nice to be with you. Let me just back up and say that when you look at the Saudi economy, it is very heavily oil dependent. Roughly 80% of Saudi Arabia's exports are oil, and about another 10% are oil related, namely plastics and petrochemicals. So when oil prices go down, Saudi Arabia is in trouble. And then the second issue is that the revenues of the country, government revenues, is about 75% comes from oil. And so when oil prices again goes down, government revenues goes down. And Saudi Arabia at the same time has some fixed expenditures that it tries to make. And those, I can list those. But basically, you know, the important ones are domestic subsidies, military expenditures, also money for the large ruling family of Saudi Arabia, which is probably around 17,000 people. All of these things cost money, and so they have to spend that. So the country basically then runs into deficits, and Saudi Arabia has budget deficits of roughly 10-12% recently. So this is not sustainable. And so when this happens, the simple guy on the road, on the streets, get actually squeezed. And so what you have to do, they can't squeeze them too much because then you have domestic problems. And so they run deficits. That's where it's at.
Okay, very well. Atifat, with Saudi Arabia so heavily dependent on oil, as we know, how do you think that the price drop has impacted the economy there and in total or overall the Saudi regime? And also, do you think that the Saudi economy is going to be suffering as a result of this, and for what length of time? Some have said could be a few years.
Well, definitely, Saudi oil income contributes to 2/3 of its public revenue. So less oil money means financial trouble in public sectors, which directly affects the people of Saudi Arabia. Now, the government might start introducing measures like rising taxes. They have started with VAT. And introducing some austerity measures, which will not be welcomed by people of Saudi Arabia. They're not accustomed to this sort of situation. At the moment, a lot of people in Saudi Arabia are critical of the government because of the rising unemployment, which will continue due to these financial difficulties. And a lot of them are saying that this situation could be prevented if the government would spend less on military and stop the war in Yemen, which brought them nothing but international condemnation, and focus that money on their people, this situation wouldn't be happening.
Okay, very well. Thanks for that. Well, let's take a look now at how Saudi Arabia is trying to move away from their reliance on oil, as bin Salman, the crown prince, tries to modernize the country, albeit to some quite rightly skeptical views from foreign nations of Saudi human rights records.
Bin Salman, the crown prince of the Saudi regime, ousted his nearest rivals in a bloodless coup that essentially made him the de facto ruler of the kingdom, going as far as imprisoning some of his relatives and even killing people who spoke out against him, none more so infamous than the brutal fashion in which the journalist Jamal Khashoggi met his fate at the hands of bin Salman's murder hit squad. Part of the regime that bin Salman wished to implement under his rule was the so-called 2030 vision, a plan that would see the kingdom introduce a strategic framework designed to reduce the nation's dependence on oil and concentrate on other sources of income. Many question whether this will be a success, with certain examples already proving to be a failure, with various sporting personalities refusing to attend high-profile events in the country. However, some have agreed, and some academics feel that the move away from oil onto more diverse projects has potential to succeed.
I think that the new approach, which is reflected in the broader 2030 vision, if implemented as outlined, it will take off. Now, that is contingent on the government and the leaders implementing, creating the enabling environment, which is very key for you to take off. This will include, of course, some of the things that have already outlined in the vision. In particular, a continuation with the development of infrastructure.
But for bin Salman and his grand idea, there still lies several fundamental flaws in his approach. Firstly, as we've discussed, is the shocking history of human rights in the country, as seen in the murder of Khashoggi, but also the inequality between men and women, the notion of modern slavery in the kingdom, the terrible ongoing destruction of Yemen, and of course, the infighting between Saudi royals themselves, all lead many to question as to just how far this project can go before it collapses. The idea, however, is something that other nations in the Persian Gulf region have also considered adopting, with the likes of the United Arab Emirates, for example, branching out into fields of tourism and technology, and the Persian Gulf state of Qatar, which is also thriving outside of its gas income, with the FIFA World Cup heading to Qatar next year, and of course the highly successful aviation industry, spearheaded by award-winning Qatar Airways, notably the only operator to thrive during the COVID-19 pandemic.
If you look at the Gulf countries, they both seem to have taken quite a similar path. They all seem to have developed a broader economic and political and social kind of framework, which they are implementing. I think the difference is that the pace of development is quite maybe slightly different, or the pace of the implementation is quite slightly different.
Joining us back in the studio is Hossein Askari. Professor, Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf states have taken huge steps to move away from economic reliance on oil, coming up with a range of alternative economic plans. Do you think that this tactic will work, or will setup costs prove too costly?
Well, I think that eventually, of course, oil runs out. And so any country has got to do something to make sure that this oil lasts in some fashion. Now, I am a firm believer in Islamic economics and what the Quran teaches about finance and economics. And it's very, very clear, no one with any brain can dispute this, that in Islam, what is under the ground, namely depletable resources, belong equally to all members of the present and future generations. But let me just say this, to be able to transform your economy from oil to something else, you need more than just a vision. You need more than just somebody saying, we're going to do this. You need to create a setup in a country where there is the rule of law and where there are incentives for the private sector to develop those things. Saudi Arabia has not done that. And so when you try to, as a government, to try to set the direction for how you're going to go from an oil economy to a non-oil economy, it's very difficult for the government to say, well, we're going to pick this particular sector, that particular sector, and invariably it doesn't work. And until you have a setup, an environment, the condition for the private sector to flourish, and Saudi Arabia does not have that. So I think it'll be a very costly mistake in the long run, because it has not done the spade work in order to set up for a resurgence of the private sector.
Okay, not too optimistic for Saudi Arabia. Atif bin Salman has stated that he wants to diversify the Saudi economy, said that many times. And of course, he's talked about this 2030 vision that Professor there also talked about, the aim to boost tourism, infrastructure, leisure, recreation, things of that nature. But there have already been several boycotts of Mohammed bin Salman, really, in particular, and Saudi Arabia as a whole, by the idea about these big brand names who and stars who want to actually make investments, but they're concerned about the human rights record of Saudi Arabia. Do you think that this plan, this vision is going to work? Or do you think that Saudi Arabia actually has too many skeletons in its closet?
Well, Mohammed bin Salman established his authority through massive crackdowns on the dissent, locking up competitors in luxury hotels, ordering the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, waging a war in Yemen, and being involved in a blockade on Qatar. Now, these sort of behaviors discourage many investors, and a lot of investors in the future are thinking, is this a man that we want to work, a pro-violence, anti-democracy guy? They're looking for safe places to invest, especially with the ongoing pandemic and the financial crisis across the globe. So I don't think that the investors are going to be encouraged to invest in this vision. And at the same time, Bin Salman was heavily reliant on the income from oil to make this dream happen. And with the drop in the oil revenues and the ongoing pandemic, I think his dream is dying away.
Okay, very well. Well, we're about to take a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere, as we have plenty more coming up, including more from Atife and a new section of our show. It's called A Thousand Words. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavita Hawaii. Time now to take a look at a change of policy in Arab Persian Gulf states in our in-depth section. Now, as we have seen in recent months, Several nations have normalized ties with the Israel regime, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Many suggest that the Saudi regime may also follow the trend, but Riyadh appears to be stalling for now. Well, according to a report by Karen Uziel of Focus Economics, which was cited in this entry, she has stated that the biggest winner of the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime will be the poorest nation, that being Sudan. Yet between Israel, the UAE, and the U.S., a $3 billion fund promoting economic developments will be launched, which may also tempt the Saudis. Now, she also has stated that for Saudi Arabia to fully and officially normalize ties with Israel will mean a change of power at the top, believing that bin Salman will have to replace his father for that to happen, which may spark huge protests and then in the process let down the people of Palestine. Well, the Israeli regime has offered to sweeten the deal with the Saudis by offering them an incentive, namely providing the so-called Iron Dome missile system once ties are normalized, something that the Saudi regime will no doubt at due time, due to his love of weapons, may jump at this. But for now, it has rejected it. Well, Israel itself is desperate for business. For example, check out this entry over here, an Israeli-Saudi Silicon Wadi to benefit both. Now, this is for the tech sector. An Israeli-Saudi union here will obviously benefit both, but Israel is looking to expand itself because of the fact that COVID-19 has affected countries around the world, and one of the main sources of income for the Saudis was the U.S. Cybersecurity, for example, is one of the fields, not to mention agritech, fintech, and digital health.
They say the difference between a man and a boy is the price of his toys. And this is no different for bin Salman, who since taking pseudo charge of the country has spent billions on military hardware, ranging from the latest fighter jets to the most devastating bombs, most of which come from Western suppliers, and in particular, the United States of America. But the military deals taking place are riddled with corruption, hence proving why so much spending has left the kingdom with such a huge deficit, all caused by the bad deals that allow certain individuals to profit in the process.
There have been, in fact, some military contracts in which the commission was larger than the actual contract, maybe over 100%. There have been military contracts in which later on what are called the add-ons were larger than the initial contract, which also tells you that there was corruption going on, so they had to basically later on come and add money to it to make up for it, namely the contractor was told what was the highest other bid so that or the lowest other bid, I'm sorry, so they could go below that. So there are all of these things why the military contracts occur.
However, for the cameras, the corruption is not an issue, as the likes of Trump and bin Salman laugh and joke about billion-dollar contracts, which Trump labelled as peanuts to the Saudi regime. The final destination of the weapons and bombs bought from the US and the UK is no laughing matter. Bin Salman's also been the mastermind and chief instigator of the ongoing war in Yemen, where the very deal signed by the Saudis to buy US weapons has seen over 233,000 people killed in the country at the hands of Saudi attacks and sanctions. With the war looking like an unwinnable mission for Riyadh, it seems that the excessive spending on military hardware, some of which has never been used, either through lack of knowledge as to how to use it, or simply not having had the opportunity to do so, has meant that the overall budget on the war has brought few tangible gains for the Saudi military. With estimates placing the Saudi spending on the war in Yemen being at around $200 million per day, it's no wonder then that the Saudi budget has run down.
We're joined back in the studio with Atafe, but before we head into our discussion, let's hear one more time from Professor Hossein Askari. We asked him a question about the Saudi military program.
The military expenditures, it's done for a variety of reasons. Let's just be very frank about it. Saudi Arabia cannot really defend itself, but it does not have anyone who wants to invade it. And if anyone does invade it, Saudi Arabia will get the backing of the United States military, and now I believe of Israel's. So why do they spend all this money on military? Well, I think it's number one is to reward the U.S. military complex, because the United States wants to export military hardware that reduces the cost of every unit that the U.S. military then buys. There's a second reason, and that is corruption. Is that in fact the commissions that are paid in military contracts are enormous. They run into the billions. So it's a way to channel money to various people inside and outside Saudi Arabia. I believe that much of that equipment is not against foreigners, but is to be used eventually if there is a domestic disturbance. And so it is prepositioned for Americans to come and help the Saudi family out.
Hey, he's a great guest for this program. Okay, Atafe, we have seen Donald Trump accepting billions of dollars from the Saudi regime, obviously in return for what Professor said there, for military weapons. This week actually saw another $290 million of arms being sold to Saudi Arabia, well, approved to be sold to Saudi Arabia. And this is a last push by Trump to arm, obviously, his friend, especially Mohammed bin Salman. Now, do you think that incoming President Joe Biden, if he does actually get confirmed, is he going to be following Trump's footsteps, do you think?
Well, Saudi Arabia has been the United States' greatest ally in this region. I don't think that alignment is going to change with Biden coming to the office. But I think Biden is a man who cares about his international image, so he would be more careful the way he treats Saudi Arabia. But in terms of economic trades, I think there are going to be more trade deals between these two countries, especially now that the United States is in financial trouble itself. But in other things, I think regarding the human rights issues, Biden would be more careful to address these issues, things that, for example, Bin Salman does, you know, the thing that he does. I think that's the only thing that would change. That's it.
Very well. Thank you very much for your input. We appreciate it. Atafe Payadar, researcher and journalist. Sure. The Saudi regime is run by a family that appears to be living a lavish lifestyle, fueled by oil sales that provide easy income to spend on luxury goods, sophisticated military weapons, and most worryingly of all, buying the silence of the Western international community following the brutal assassination of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But it seems that the impact of the coronavirus and the slump in oil prices have left the bank vaults of the Saudi regime with bare shelves, raising the question as to whether the kingdom is being mismanaged by a young, inexperienced, and power-hungry crown prince who is yet to understand the value of money. What now remains to be seen is whether oil prices will increase in the near future, and if so, what lies ahead for the Saudi regime, with outgoing President Trump causing Riyadh to lose yet another ally, and hence the possible reason why it is now extending the hand of friendship to Tel Aviv, something that many will no doubt condemn as an act of treason. That's just about all the time we have for this episode. I'd like to thank both Professor Hossein Askari and Professor Collins Nitnim for being on the show. And on behalf of myself, Atafe, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A Yemeni health ministry official says 100,000 newborn babies die every year in the impoverished country due to ongoing war of aggression and total blockade imposed on Yemen by the Saudi-led military coalition. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Ali Al-Mujahid and Sundarsan Raghavan under the heading, "At a Yemen Hospital Racked by US Funding Cuts, Children Dying of Hunger." The article has been published by the Washington Post. Please stay with us for more of Ali Al-Mujahid and Sundarsan Raghavan's article. Her infant son, weakened by hunger, needed a better-equipped hospital in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, roughly 30 miles away. But Hanan Saleh could no longer afford even the $30 taxi fare. Employees of a human rights organization and hospital officials said before she depended on a Western aid organization, Save the Children, for funds drawn from money donated by the United States to cover the travel costs. But last year, the United States government slashed its funding to United Nations groups and other such groups as Save the Children. So Hanan Saleh had to raise money to treat her son Muhammad in Sana'a until those funds ran out altogether. Her last option was a small hospital in this northern Yemeni market town, a 15-minute walk from their home. The staff tried to build up his skeletal, malnourished 9-month-old body. Breaking down in tears, Hanan Saleh recalled in November he died 2 months ago. Aid cuts by the Trump administration and other Western countries are worsening Yemen's humanitarian crisis, already considered the worst, the most severe in the world. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs for Yemen, last year's pledges totaling $1.61 billion were less than half of 2019's funding, and hundreds of millions of dollars committed by donors have not yet been paid. United Nations officials say at least 15 of the UN's 41 major programs have been scaled back or closed altogether, and additional programs could shutter in the months to come if more funds are not received. Humanitarian aid groups fear the crisis would get even worse if the Trump administration, in its waning days, goes ahead with plans to designate the Ansar Allah fighters as a foreign terrorist organization. It would prevent numerous Western aid organizations concerned about prosecution for perceived support of the group from operating in Ansar-controlled areas where most Yemenis live. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned in a recent statement, the reduction in funding comes at a time when Yemen is now in imminent danger of the worst famine in the world, the worst famine that the world has seen for decades. Guterres added, in the absence of immediate action, millions of lives may be lost. Aidan O'Leary, head of the United Nations Humanitarian Office in Yemen, said the lack of funding could result in emergency food aid being suspended for 5 million Yemenis and basic health care for 9 million people, including more than 500,000 malnourished Yemeni children. Aid workers said an economy in freefall, a locust infestation and devastating floods, as well as spread of the coronavirus, have compounded the humanitarian woes in Yemen. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says today more than 24 million Yemenis, roughly 80% of the population of the country, require humanitarian assistance, including more than 12 million Yemeni children. According to Oxfam, half of all medical facilities are closed or not operational. Cholera, dengue fever and other diseases have shattered the immune systems of millions of Yemenis, leaving them more vulnerable to the coronavirus. In March, the Trump administration suspended at least $73 million in aid after wrongly accusing the Ansar movement of diverting and disrupting aid. Other Western donors followed suit. In October, a UNICEF study found that acute malnutrition rates among Yemeni children under the age of 5 in some parts of the country were the highest ever recorded. The Radar Hospital is far less equipped than a fully-fledged hospital but receives patients from across the region. Save the Children, a charity that receives government funding, once paid for most salaries, medicines, nutritional supplements, hygiene equipment, and first aid services. Abdullah Saleh Al-Tam, the hospital's general manager, said, these things have stopped since March, he added. As a result, the situation here has deteriorated in the past few months. He said today, patients with chronic diseases cannot find basic medicines for respiratory illnesses, for diarrhea, and for malnutrition. Al-Tam said, even those who were financially okay have started showing signs of malnutrition, he added. It's not only children, but also pregnant women and breastfeeding women. In 2019, Save the Children reached 1.2 million adults and children across northern Yemen, including the area where the Radar Hospital is located. Last year, the funding cuts forced the charity to reduce food support to 21,000 Yemeni households. Referring to the 1.2 million Yemenis they once reached, Anna Pantelia, a spokesperson for Save the Children, said the reduction in aid has left them in an uncertain fate. Imal Mahati, a nurse at the Radar Hospital who is under contract with Save the Children, said there are many people unable to even afford the trip to the hospital. Karimal Mahati said, in the past, we would cover not only the transportation costs but also traveling costs to Radar Hospital or even from as far away as Sana'a. She added, however, 3 months ago, we were forced to stop. Abdullah Al-Tam added, in October, 6 or 7 children died because their families couldn't afford taking them to hospital. All of them were under the age of 5. He said, recently, we were forced to turn away parents whose children needed the food when we ran out of food supplies. Several months ago, 18-year-old Hind Al-Qarre brought her twin girls to Radar Hospital. Anas and Iman, 10 months old, suffered from severe malnutrition and diarrhea. Anas was worse off. She weighed about 6 pounds. Mansour Matar, a medical assistant who runs the nutrition department at the hospital, recalled she was literally skin and bones. Her case was so severe that he advised Qarre to take her infant daughter to a larger hospital in the provincial capital, but the family could not afford it and funds from Save the Children were no longer available. So Matar and other hospital employees raised money to pay for medicine and nutritional supplements. He made follow-up visits to the family's home. Khadra said, now Anas is 5.4 kilograms, or nearly 12 pounds. But countless infants don't survive. This is especially so in remote areas of Yemen, where even getting a small facility has become financially prohibitive. Fatima Al-Wadei, a nurse at the Al-Madan clinic about 100 miles north of Raida Hospital, said she has told many parents that funding for transportation to larger hospitals has ended. Fatima Al-Wadei said, so they go back home. Frankly, many children I know have died at home as a result. She said, Saleh, the mother who initially couldn't afford the taxi fare to Sana'a, came close to saving her son Muhammad. In May, after she learned about the funding cutbacks, she and her husband begged for money from relatives, friends and neighbors. They raised $1,700 and took Muhammad to the main hospital in Sana'a. Their money, used for blood transfusions and other medical needs, lasted 1 month. Saleh said, against their doctor's advice, they headed back to their village because we had no more money or means to get that money. That's when they started bringing Muhammad again and again, whenever he was ill, to the Raida hospital, until he died last November. Wiping the tears away from her face, his mother said, I'm so heartbroken because I felt helpless and wasn't able to do anything. A Yemeni health ministry official says 100,000 newborn babies die every year in the impoverished country due to the ongoing war of aggression and total blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its military coalition. In an interview with Yemen's Arabic language Al-Masira television network, the Undersecretary of the Ministry of Health, Najib Al-Qobati, announced the grim news recently, saying, this means that every 2 hours, 6 Yemeni children lose their lives because of the years-long Saudi-imposed blockade of Yemen. He added, the Saudi-led coalition has been preventing the entry of advanced medical equipment since March of 2015. When Saudi Arabia, along with several of its allies, invaded Yemen, allegedly to bring the former fugitive president back to power. Al-Qobati said, we have been unable to bring medical personnel into the country due to the siege and aggression of Saudi Arabia. The Undersecretary of Yemen's Health Ministry also warned that the rates of malnutrition among Yemeni children and their mothers are very high. Back in September, Yemen's Human Rights Center said in a report titled Childhood with the Color of Blood and the Smell of Death, that some 7,200 Yemeni children were either killed or wounded by the Saudi-imposed war. It revealed of these ill-fated children, 3,468 of them were killed. The center further said at the time that some 5,500,000 Yemeni children were also at risk of catching diseases because of malnutrition and shortage of healthcare services. Late last year, Yemen's health ministry warned that around 3 million children under the age of 5 were suffering from malnutrition, 400,000 of whom were suffering from severe malnutrition and at risk of death every 10 minutes if they did not receive appropriate medical care. The brutal Saudi-imposed war has destroyed or closed half of Yemen's hospitals and clinics, leaving many Yemenis helpless, particularly at a time when they're in desperate need of medical supplies to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. At least 80% of the 28 million-strong population of Yemen is also reliant on aid to survive in what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Divide.
When one considers how the United States portrays itself in the media and in folklore, it's easy to be fooled into thinking that the streets are paved with gold and everything is bigger and better in the US. However, recent events have clearly shown that the country is flawed to the core. It's hence why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has questioned just where this utopian image of the United States has gone, as he stated that today we can see what this big idol has turned into. The leader went on to question the rationale of those who still worship the United States, clearly suggesting that some are blinded by ignorance as they fail to see events unfolding before them in Washington and other major US towns and cities across America. Speaking on the economy, the leader also noted the crippling effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on the United States, with the world's highest death rate and numbers reflecting a huge slump in finances, with many people losing their jobs and businesses collapsing due to a lack of positive action by the US government. But the most valid point of all was the leader's analysis on the recent election that took place in the US, not focusing on the result, but on the process and aftermath, with the leader labelling the whole election as a fiasco, sparked of course by the outrageous actions by the outgoing president Donald Trump for inciting violence. In truth, Ayatollah Khamenei had been quoting similar views long before the arrival of the COVID-19 virus, the collapse of the US economy, and of course the disgusting behaviour demonstrated by Trump and his droogs. So did the leader have a point when he delivered his observations this time round?
He does have a point, because I think what people aren't recognising when they see the US from the outside is that it's going through a fundamental decline. That's hard to believe, and the decline is often not easily, if you like, recognizable. But let me just give you a few indicators. Since 2008, the United States has gone into a 200% increase, a surge in its national debt. $27 trillion is the current United States debt. That's, you know, 200% increase, as I say, over the last 10 or so years.
With the imminent departure of Donald Trump, the arrival of a US president has left some people feeling optimistic of change, both in America and around the world. Many have questioned the notion of the US and Iran reconciling sometime in the near future under the presidency of Joe Biden. However, with the leader stating that some feel if this happens, Iran will become a paradise, will a relationship with the Americans genuinely benefit Iran?
Well, I think that, Ayatollah Khamenei points to this idea of people who may think that a deal with America will in some way give economic benefits to Iran overnight. This is not going to be the case. You know, the deals that the Iranians will have to do in order to really stand any chance of any kind of collaboration from America are going to be morally impossible for Iran to go ahead with.
But the truth of the matter is, Iran's in no rush to reach out the hand of friendship to the US, with the Americans imposing sanctions on Iran, as well as assassinating Iran's chief counter-terrorism commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. It's also why Iran are not waiting for a knock on the door from America to rejoin the JCPOA. With Iran proving itself to be a successfully self-sufficient nation, as well as showing the world that it was and still is more than able to stand up and defeat the American maximum pressure policy, it's no wonder that Iran can stand tall, proud and confident in its rhetoric. With an abundance of natural resources, four seasons that gift Iran with a fertile and beautiful land, and of course a culture spanning back 5,000 years, it seems that Iran has a lot to be proud of and is already a slice of paradise.
The United States is still reeling from what happened at the heart of the American democracy in the capital of the nation on Wednesday. The unprecedented chaos in Washington, D.C. has been described by many as a shattering blow to the image of America. The extent of polarization of the American society was on full display on Wednesday. Supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump, encouraged by him, marched to the Capitol building as the Congress was meeting to confirm Joe Biden's election victory. Chaotic scenes erupted as Trump supporters clashed with security forces and stormed the Capitol building. The violent mayhem temporarily blocked the counting of the Electoral College votes. Several people lost their lives inside and outside the Congress building. Trump, who has repeated claims of a stolen election, was widely condemned for inciting violence in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday.
What led to this one has been, in terms of its most recent context, 4 years of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump lying to the American people about a number of things, but most recently lying to the American people about the election and the fact that that he won in his mind.
The storming of the Capitol building triggered a number of resignations from Trump's team less than 2 weeks before the outgoing president's term will be over. Meanwhile, senior Democrats are calling for Trump to be removed immediately. They want him to be forced out of office now, either under the disability clause of the 25th Amendment or through an impeachment. 4 years of Trump's divisive presidency seems to have fueled different divisions in the American society to an unprecedented level. The unprecedented violence in Washington, D.C. will undoubtedly be hard for America to recover from. Soon after the storming of the Capitol building by his supporters, Trump committed to an orderly transition of power later this month. But the damage is done. The bitter developments of this week seem to have hugely dented the credibility of America's democracy. Meanwhile, Wednesday's events in Washington drew reactions from around the world. Some countries went so far as to say that the chaos exposed internal collapse in the American political system and that the events showed Western democracy is fragile and broken.
America has been championing this fraud that America is the, as Ronald Reagan said, the shining city on the hill, and we profess to be the bastion of democracy. But the best way that America seems to be able to bring democracy to other places is at the barrel of a gun. And so what I honestly believe that this has done is it has exposed the hypocrisy of America.
American officials have long lectured the leaders of other countries on democratic values and peaceful transfer of power from one elected president to another. Americans have been very proud of peaceful and smooth handover of government every 4 years, but that did not happen this time. Some observers believe the post-election chaos in the United States shows a growing lack of trust in the system and elections. One recent opinion poll shows more than half of Republican voters believe Trump rightfully won the election. That's tens of millions of Americans that don't trust the election result. The incoming administration of Joe Biden will face many domestic and foreign challenges. But right now, perhaps leading a divided America will probably be the toughest task facing the future president of the United States.
Defend the Constitution.
Saudi Arabia, in a U-turn on its diplomatic course, has decided to lift its land, air, and sea blockade on Qatar following more than 3 years of a standoff between the two countries. The decision was announced at a Persian Gulf Cooperation Council summit held in the Saudi city of Al Ula. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said the kingdom signed a rapprochement agreement with Qatar along with Oman and Kuwait. The prince, a de facto ruler, hailed the agreement, saying the attending nations reaffirmed their Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability. He also thanked the United States and Kuwait for their mediation. The deal, however, seems to be pursuing nothing but an anti-Iran policy by Riyadh. During the summit, MBS repeated the kingdom's anti-Tehran rhetoric, saying there was a desperate need to unite their efforts to what he called develop the West Asia region and confront challenges, especially those posed by Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile program. the Saudi-Qatar rapprochement comes more than 3 years after Riyadh, along with its regional hawks, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt, cut their diplomatic and economic ties with Doha. They sealed their borders and expelled Qatari citizens from their countries. They accused Doha of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. Qatar, however, strongly rejected those allegations, arguing that it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for reconciliation. Qatar, however, did not publicly bow to any of their demands. But what has really caused the Saudi regime to lift this blockade on Qatar and resettle relations with Doha at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump, one of Saudi's main backers in the international coalition against Iran, is leaving office within weeks?
At this point, Saudi Arabian government knows that Trump is leaving office shortly, and the Biden administration will not be quite as sympathetic to its rogue activities as the Trump administration has been. So for this reason, Saudi Arabia wants to reestablish or at least normalize its ties with Qatar, and that's the reason for them doing this at this time.
While the reconciliation agreement between Saudi Arabia and Qatar is still preliminary in nature, questions arise as to why Riyadh makes a sudden U-turn in its approach toward Doha. Observers say Saudi Arabia is pursuing its own interests.
Saudi Arabia is certainly pursuing its own interests. It isn't acting in the interests of that region of the world or of Qatar, but it does see that the end of the U.S. government's permission to do whatever it chooses is in sight. Also, the Saudi Arabian government realizes that this blockade has not been effective. Qatar has not given in to any of the 13 demands that Saudi Arabia issued when it started this in 2017. So it's been a complete failure. So in order to save face, perhaps, and also to perhaps curry favor with the Biden administration, it is at this time reestablishing these relations with Qatar.
The latest Saudi posture comes in the backdrop of its growing nexus with the Israeli regime. It is no more a secret that the kingdom is seeking to normalize relations with Israel. That came into the spotlight, especially after Donald Trump's senior advisor Jared Kushner said a normalization agreement between Riyadh and Tel Aviv was very imminent. Even the recent U.S. brokered normalization between some Arab countries, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco with Israel, could not have been possible without the Saudi blessing. All in all, what looks to be true is the fact that Saudi Arabia is seeking to establish an anti-Iran front to stand against the Iranian influence in the region.
Because of the recent Arab countries that have established ties with Israel, Saudi Arabia would like to see Qatar join them and then have a more unified front against Iran. However, these nations aren't as willing to demonize Iran as Saudi Arabia is, as the United States is. They see, and Qatar would see, any affiliation with Israel as unrelated to its alliance with Iran.
Riyadh has long accused the Islamic Republic of seeking to destabilize the region. But one may question, isn't it Riyadh that has constantly pursued the policy of fueling regional tensions? From maintaining its interference in Libya and Bahrain, Riyadh has also imposed a full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen, killing and maiming tens of thousands of civilians over the past 6 years. What one may also question is how far the Saudi regime seeking to expose its hegemonic agenda in West Asia and beyond.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state, and flipping the state is a great testament to our country.
These are the words of the U.S.